The idea of ahimsa is most of us, in, I think, nowadays know if we know the term at all, we know of it coming from Gandhi. Gandhi was the great exponent of ahimsa, non-violence or non-harming, in India in the last century, and he inspired many people, many people. Martin Luther King, just one of them, partly because of Mahatma Gandhi. There are now, in different universities around the country, there are peace departments. There are departments that actually focus on this topic of peace and nonviolence. And it's become kind of an academic discipline of sorts. It's become respectable thing to explore. And the idea of ahimsa goes back into ancient India. It's not something that just comes from Buddhism. It's kind of in the milieu of ancient Indian religions. And Buddhism had a particular slant, particular take on it. But ahimsa is very important in the teachings of the Buddha. The principle, the idea of living a life which is non-harming. And it's so important that it could be considered to be foundation, not only foundational, really foundational, central, and all else comes from it. It's like the root virtue, when all other virtues kind of grow on that initial virtue. But also, it's a wonderful way of seeing how the end result of practice, if there is one in a sense of in awakening or the culmination of practice, it resonates with the state of mind which is devoted towards non-harming. So there's kind of a resonance or kind of a parallel or between the attempt, the efforts to live a life that's not harming with a goal of practice itself. The enlightened person is one who lives a life at peace that has non-harming as one of the central expressions of how that person lives their lives. And I think of the peace, the freedom that can come in the mind from practice is a kind of freedom that comes when there's no more conflict, no conflict at all. We don't feel like we're in conflict with others, and we don't feel like we're in conflict with ourselves. So there's kind of, all conflict is settled, and that's where the peace is. And the external manifestation of that is, you know, non-harming towards others. So I want to read a couple of quotes from the Buddha about this topic. And what you'll see is that there are at least two ways of looking at this idea of ahimsa. One is that it's a principle. And a principle is not necessarily something that you can live up to all the time, but it's a principle you try to live by. It's like a guiding light or a guiding star. You look at that and you know that's where you have to walk in that direction. So you have this principle of non-harming, and that's kind of the orientation that you're trying to direct your life on, this idea of non-harming. And the question for us today is, why was this so important for the Buddha? Why would the Buddha lay this down as being one of the primary, central principles upon which he placed the spiritual life? So that's one, the principle. And the other is that it's a rule in the form of, for example, not killing. And the rule is particularly strong for monastics. And there's no excommunication in Buddhism, in a sense. But the closest thing to it is that if a person is a monastic, a monk or nun, there's four different things that person can do. It's laid out. They have all these rules they have to live, rules of their order they have to live by. And the first four of those rules, if any one of those rules is violated, then automatically, without any ruling by the Vatican or anybody else, just automatically that person is no longer a monastic. And the person can no longer be monastic in this lifetime. So it's very serious for a monastic to break these rules. And one of these three rules is not to kill. It's kind of almost absolute in the sense that there's no... In Theravada monasticism. And this is rule number three of these first four rules. Should any monk intentionally deprive a human being of life, or search for an assassin for him or her, or praise the advantages of death, or incite him to die thus, my good man, what use is this wretched, miserable life to you? Death would be better for you than life. or with such an idea in mind, such a purpose in mind, should in various ways praise the advantages of death or incite someone to die, he is also defeated and no longer in communion. So that's a very interesting statement. It's kind of packed with all kinds of implications. So you cannot kill anyone. That's absolute. And you can't find someone else to do the work for you. That's just as bad, an assassin. And you cannot praise the advantages of death. And this is usually, this is many ways of understanding this, but one way that it's interpreted is that the Buddhist monastics are not allowed to encourage euthanasia. They might allow someone to die naturally, not intervene with all kinds of medical apparatus to keep them alive, but to actually encourage people or advise people, anybody, that, you know, you're so sick now, things are so dire, you know, I think you're better off just, you know, doing a, you know, medically assisted suicide or something like that. That is a complete no-no for monastics. And is this a principle or is it a rule? Is it an expression of this principle of non-harming? Is it a training rule by which the monastics live their life by? Is it because monastics are not supposed to in any kind of way compromise themselves internally or externally around this principle of being harmless, living a life which is harmless? Lesser rules for monastics, they're not as serious. They require confession and things like that, but you don't get kicked out of the order. One of them is, should any monk knowingly deprive an animal of life, it is to be confessed. So you're not allowed to kill animals. You're also not allowed to harm plants. And it goes to this extreme. Should any monk knowingly make use of water with living beings in it, it is to be confessed. So you can't even drink water that you, like there's, you know, insects or something in. So you find, in ancient India at least, that monastics would carry around these filters, cloth filters, and they'd filter the water before they drank it, or so that whatever animals were in it would come out, and they wouldn't have to kill even the animals in the water. And the problem with this, of course, is that now in the modern world, we realize that, you know, every little, you know, drop of saliva has a billion little creatures in it, and so, you know, the idea of not killing animals becomes almost impossible or impossible. But this movement to live a life of harmlessness. And then another rule, it also requires confession, even lesser rule, emphasizing the importance of harmlessness. Should any monk purposefully provoke anxiety in another monk, thinking, this way, even for just a moment, he will have no peace? If doing it for just this reason and no other, it is to be confessed. So you're not allowed to intentionally do something that provokes anxiety in someone else. It might be a reason to, you know, you might say something that causes anxiety, but you can't want to do that. You're not trying to. There isn't a movement of cruelty or ill will in your mind that you're trying to express. And here is the another. This is not exactly it's kind of an explanation of this rule of non-killing for monastics. That this is instructions given to every new monk. A monk who has been admitted to the order should not deprive a living being of life, even if it is only a black and white ant. Any monk who purposely deprives a human life, even to the extent of causing an abortion, is not a contemplative, not a son of the Buddha. Just as a solid block of stone broken in two cannot be joined together again, in the same way, a monk who has purposely deprived a human being of life is not a contemplative, is not a son of the Buddha or daughter of the Buddha. You are not to do this for the rest of your life. That's the instruction, at least the rest of your life that you're ordained. And here, the extension is to the extent of causing an abortion. So certainly a monastic cannot perform an abortion, nor can they advise someone to do an abortion. Now that raises all kinds of questions and controversy and anxiety in a lot of people, this issue of abortion. And it's very interesting that we have abortion as a major theme for our location here at IMC. If you drive by our center on a Thursday or Friday morning between 9 and 11 maybe, you're in for quite a sight, because there's anti-abortion protesters lining up around the corner here, because Planned Parenthood is across the street. So does this mean that Buddhism is against abortion? It's a little bit hard to extrapolate from that, but what it literally says is a person's monastic, a monastic person cannot be engaged in that kind of activity. How does that apply then to lay people? And this is my suggestion, is that how to extrapolate from, well, say this, the Buddha did not have a lot to say about lay ethics. It's kind of like this, that the impression I get from the suttas is the Buddha didn't feel that it was his place to go around preaching to people and telling people how they should live their life and what they should do. He didn't go around kind of making these blanket statements, you know, thou shalt live this way or whatever. He was mostly interested in talking to people who came to him and asked them questions about how they should live their lives. And the people who were ordained as monks or nuns, they were very clearly kind of putting themselves under his direction in a very complete way for the purposes of attaining liberation in this lifetime. And so a lot of the way of life, a lot of the rules, the way monastics live, was to create the proper foundation, the proper conditions, so they can live a life that is most conducive towards attaining liberation in this lifetime. Another way of understanding this is that for people who are quite serious in their spiritual practice, it's imperative to try to live a harmless life. So here, lay people, so the Buddha didn't say a lot about lay people. They can live their life the way they want. But if a lay person comes to the Buddha and says, you know, this is how I want to take refuge in the Buddha. I want to be protected by the teachings of the Buddha. I want to kind of align myself by those teachings. But they're not really interested in liberation. Then the Buddha would lay, okay, in that case, if you want to take the refuges, then you have to live by the five precepts. But if a lay person is as serious about attaining liberation as a monastic, then I think there's a higher threshold of ethics that the person needs to live by. And what I've seen in some lay people who practice is that threshold of their ethical life slowly increases over years. It's not necessarily something you have to kind of automatically assume you have to do, live up to. But rather, as a person's practice deepens, there seems to be almost a natural inclination or wish or just inspiration to live a more ethical life. And so it kind of goes, you know, hand in hand. As a practice deepens, a person's inspired to live a more ethical life. So it's not a burden necessarily. You don't feel like you're in conflict with yourself or struggling in some too much of a dramatic way. I was a little boy told me recently, I was back east visiting people, and a boy told me, oh, in my uncle's house, they kill insects. But in our household, we carry them outside. And he was very happy with that. It was lovely that some kid would say that. He was growing up with the idea that, you know, our household, we don't kill, we take care of things outside. So why is it, do you think, that the Buddha would put such a premium on non-harming and the extension of non-harming, not killing? So not killing is an absolute rule. And in fact, for the lay people, those who take the five precepts, it says, for the purposes of training, so it's not an absolute commandment, but if you're interested in spiritual training that the Buddha offers, for that purpose, do not kill. And there's no exception to that, according to the Buddha. A lot of people will have exceptions for themselves, and a lot of Buddhists will have exceptions to themselves in various ways. I mean, one maybe very unsatisfying exception. If we give one example, I think it's maybe in Nepal. So Buddhists are not supposed to kill, But they would, you know, farmers, local people would kill their sheep in order to have meat for the table and stuff. And so they had a system where sometimes where they would have this wall compound. The wall was kind of a small area where the wall was quite high. And they would, a few people would gather around outside with stones, and they'd throw stones over the wall on top of the sheep. So they've never, they never could know who was killing him. Because, you know, you weren't actually trying to kill. You were just throwing a stone over. And one of the stones would kill. But, you know, maybe it wasn't yours. It was, you know, your neighbor's. So it's very unsatisfying, right? A more satisfying one, also from Nepal, is if you go to Nepal, you can actually see, and at least I think still today when I was there, you can see sheep being sacramentally sacrificed, you know, just on the street there, because as part of Hindu ritual tradition. And you have these big stones, and they slit the throat, and the blood's all over, and it's kind of gory. And apparently they have this festival in Nepal, that big kind of affair. But part of this festival is everyone slaughters a sheep. And but there's also the Niwaris, or a population of Buddhists in Kathmandu. And so they participate in this annual festival. But what they do is they're really gruesome about this. And they do it on their doorstep in front of their house. They get a you know, big hatchet and knife, and then they get a watermelon, and they slaughter the watermelon. And so all the red and all the juice kind of drips out on the steps. And that's the way they participate in this kind of, you know, national thing. So that was very nice. So what do you think? What are your reflections now? And what are your thoughts about why non-harming is such a central principle in Buddhism, teachings of the Buddha, and why non-killing should be bumped up, not just to be a principle, but also to be kind of a very, very heavy rule for the monastics? Yes? Yeah, there seems to, I don't understand this too well, but there seems to be one little minor exception where suicide is not condoned but allowed. And this is, that monk was had already finished his practice. He was fully enlightened. And being so sick, and in that situation, it was, you know, I guess this euthanasia was okay. But no one is supposed to encourage him to do that. Yes?
If an animal has been very seriously wounded by some other cause and is probably never going to be okay again, then is the mercy pulling of the animal to put out its misery considered out of bounds?
It would be for a monastic. And then the question is, you know, how do you extrapolate that to a layperson? The rule is not to kill. And this is where there's a very interesting contrast between kind of the early Buddhist teachings and what still continues in Theravadan Buddhism and what developed in the Mahayana. And the early Buddhist tradition tended to be quite strict about this rule that, you know, no killing no matter what. In the Mahayana, there arose the idea that because of compassion and concern for the other person, there might be situations where it's for the welfare of the other, or some kind of provide some welfare for the world, to be involved in breaking a precept like this. And it isn't that the precept is suspended. However, the person understands that there's a greater good being created, perhaps by something like that. And so it takes more extreme forms, for example, that they talk about in some of the Mahayana texts, that if there's some really terrible despot who is, you know, killing people left and right and causing a lot of damage, then is it, can the, if the, if a monk has access to that despot, do they have, is it okay to kill them? And the Mahayana would say, this is not universal in the Mahayana even, but you find some Mahayana thinkers who would say, oh, in that situation, out of compassion for all the people that's going to be saved, because a despot is killed, they can't kill any more people, you should kill that person. But the consequence of that for the monastic is that monk or nun will, you know, according to traditional kind of mythology of rebirths, that person will be reborn in hell for a while. So there are consequences of that. So you don't mitigate the consequences of those kinds of actions. So so that's something, you know, that's a very interesting issue that you raise then, and this divide in the Buddhist tradition between those people who see these rules as being absolute and those people who will mitigate the rules and the principles because of some powerful concern of compassion. The word ahimsa has, ahimsa means to injure or to harm, and ah means not. But often in Pali, when there's a negative with ah in front of it, it has a different connotation than our English, where it's just the absence of harming, you know, non-harming. It often implies the positive corollary, the positive virtue, so that it's said that ahimsa is often equated with compassion. The expression of ahimsa is compassion. It's not doing nothing. So then the question is, you know, how do we live our life? What motivations do we have if compassion is a primary principle? And this is a big debate in Buddhism. Yes?
I just wonder, listening to it about not harming and not killing, then how does that relate to the diet in terms of being a vegetarian or not being a vegetarian and eating meat?
Uh-huh. So the issue of diet and vegetarian... again, there's also a divide in Buddhism around this topic. In the Pali tradition, where the Buddha was teachings of the Buddha, he had a cousin named Devadatta, who was kind of considered to be a bad person, kind of evil Devadatta. And he did things like he tried to kill the Buddha, for example, various times. And he was a monk, and he was trying to kind of basically wanted to kind of a power play. He wanted to take over the order, kind of bump his cousin aside or his uncle aside or something, and take over. And he had various strategies for doing that. But one of the strategies he thought, oh, what I'm going to ordain stricter rules than the Buddha has ordained for the monks. And if people see that I'm much purer than the Buddha, and then all the disciples of the Buddha and all the lay followers will come over to me because I'm pure. And one of the rules he tried to instigate was the idea that no eating of meat. A much more pure teaching of non-harming. What the Buddha said about it for the monastics, he didn't say much as far as I know at all for lay people. But what he said for monastics is he said, monastics are not allowed to eat meat if they know the animal was killed for their sake. But you can imagine the monastics are going around India with their bowls and they can only eat what's offered to them. And then people don't even know they're coming down, you know, because they're wandering around. And people are cooking the food they're cooking in their own homes. And so people are cooking meat. And they don't, you know, cooking the meat for the monastic, but the monastic happens to walk down the street. They say, oh, wait a minute. Let me share with you some of my family's food that I have on my table here. And so they plop the food in the bowl, and some of that food is the meat. So they're supposed to eat whatever's offered to them, unless that meat is knowingly been killed for them. When you get to places like later in India, after the early tradition, there were some Buddhist orders that then ruled that the monastics should be vegetarian. And some of that then traveled into China. And you find in China and Japan, and even in China, Korea, and Japan, that there's a very strict rule about not eating meat. In Japan, Japanese monastery where I trained in, there was never any meat cooked in the monastery. But the monks were not vegetarian. So what happened there was sometimes the monastery was given cooked food because the monks would go out into the community and people would offer food and bring the cooked food back. And if there was meat, we would eat that meat. And then once we had a backpacking, not a backpacking, a hiking trip up into the mountains away from the monastery. And then we had a barbecue because we weren't because we weren't, you know, at the monastery anymore, so the rules didn't apply. And Chinese monks tend to be much stricter about this, no meat. When I was in the monastery in Burma, they served a lot of pork, and in bowls and covered with oil. Everything was in oil, lots of oil, and anyways, all this pork. And most of the Westerners didn't eat the meat there. Most of the Western practitioners that I encountered in Asia were vegetarian. And some of them stopped being vegetarian because it was so hard to get proper nourishment unless you ate something besides just rice. But there was all this pork being served. And there's a huge monastery. Sometimes there were 5,000 people there, but there were hundreds of monks and nuns. And so I went to the abbot one day and tried to explain to him the economics of supply and demand. And, the monastery, some layperson in the monastery would go out into the market to the butchers and buy all this pork and bring it back and then cook it there and serve. And so the monks weren't involved in buying it, but I said, look, you guys buy so many pounds of pork that probably, the people in the market, they're planning for you coming to buy. And so if you didn't, if you weren't going to buy, if you were a vegetarian, probably fewer pigs would be killed. Because there wouldn't be such a big demand, because you're a big source of the demand here, and maybe I didn't explain it very well, but he didn't have a clue what I was talking about. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And presumably some of them were liberated, at least in some fashion. There's some evidence of that. So those are issues. On the other hand, if you kill a person, you're depriving them of the opportunity, perhaps depriving them of the opportunity to be liberated in this lifetime or at the time that they die.
Yeah, and that's certainly one of the reasons to oppose capital punishment, is because you deny the person that opportunity for some radical transformation. And the issue of Bushido and samurais and that whole thing, in addition to that, there were in Japan monks, a kind of a category of monks that were warriors, were fighters. And often they would be, sometimes they'd fight other monasteries and do various things, and you find in different Asian Buddhist countries you find occasionally this phenomenon of warrior monks, and you find in Thailand in the 1970s, 60s, a famous monk who said to kill a communist was not breaking the precept. And so you find, all kinds. In Sri Lanka also you find some, So what you find is, a difference between, for example, principle and teachings and how it's understood and applied by different people. And generally, Buddhists overall, I think, have been a peaceful lot compared to what some other examples we can think of in religions. But we shouldn't idealize Buddhism too greatly, because there are, currents in Buddhism that haven't been as dedicated to peace as I think the Buddha was emphasizing. Some people would say the warrior monk model or the Bushido samurai model is a perversion of the teachings of Buddhism. And are they really enlightened? Do they have some experience of enlightenment? Maybe. Maybe they have something. Maybe they have some kind of an initial first stage of enlightenment before they're really transformed and purified completely. But more likely, I think what happened to the kind of Zen-inspired Bushido movement was that they developed powerful concentration. And that powerful concentration sometimes is mistaken for enlightenment. But there isn't a really deep transformation that happens. And with that concentrated, one of the dangers of having a very strong concentrated state that then is yoked with idealism or arrogance or conceit is that a lot of damage can be done because the person is so confident in themselves.
Interesting to note that the death, the reason for death is so much of the practice of nonviolence in Dalai Lama, because before Buddhism went to Tibet, it was a very violent culture, a very warring culture, and it's felt that the stuff wasn't working. And you have the example of King Ashoka, who was a warrior king, and he finally got disgusted with the whole thing and gave it up.
Yes.
As a lay practitioner, I have a lot of conflict with this issue, and it has to do only with boundaries of my household and my garden. Well, once I get outside of that, I have no problem at all trying with great intention not to kill. But in that confines, I do have conflicts with it, and I don't know what to do. I do everything I can to try to make my home not hospitable to ants and to spiders. That's sort of my issue, maybe gophers in the garden. But I don't have a good way inside of me of with this issue. So I'm in conflict with about it.
Good. Do you have a question? It was a nice report. I appreciated it. It's very common when talks are given on the first precept of not killing, people to ask about, you know, people, a lot of people are supportive of the idea in some ways, and then one of the places people struggle with it kind of in the immediacy of their life, because most of you here I don't think are involved in killing other people or neighbors and things. And so that's not really so relevant, and you're not butchers, and so. But it comes to play, you know, with around our house, like you said, you know, with insects and gophers and things. And my own attitude towards answering those kinds of questions is to say that I'm very, very appreciative of people who have the concern to be engaged in these questions. So aren't just kind of blowing off, you know, just kill the gopher or kill the insects. But it really engages. Is there an alternative? Is there some other way of doing it? And exploring, really working with that, and concerned with that. And I really, really encourage people to kind of keep that kind of line of inquiry going, and don't just take the lazy way out. But you know what you're going to decide to do? I don't know. I know sometimes I've weighed for myself. I've weighed the consequences in both directions. And sometimes it seems to be a greater loss. If termites destroy my house, and I'm supposed to be creating a healthy environment for my kids to grow up in, maybe I'm destroying something else. But I'll try everything I can to try to find alternative ways. So where I live now, we have a lot of ants that come periodically. And when we first moved there, I was kind of much more concerned about ants, and oh no, there's ants are there. And we mostly I would sweep them up and take them outside. But I didn't feel so good about that because, if you sweep them outside away from where they come from, it's kind of like, isn't it kind of like death for an ant? Because if they're not part of their little colony and they're off on their own, it's like, you know, it's kind of like, that's it, right? So it seems like not ideal. So we do all the things, you know, try to keep everything clean and, you know, everything, try to do everything and try various things to keep them at bay. And it works pretty well. But what we come to mostly is we do all those things, so it's not too bad. And then we just live with them. It's okay to have ants in the kitchen floor, a few ants in the counter, and they're kind of going exploring a little bit here and there. And it doesn't seem to be a problem. Why shouldn't they have rights to the house as much as I do? You know, they shouldn't invite all their friends. But, you know, so that we, you know, have this coexistence going on.
Not with the termites.
Oh, we don't have termites, as far as I know, so don't have to face that.
Some point.
Oh, so
your aunt would be your friend.
Oh, so coexisting with them is a good thing.
Yes. That if you really want to get rid of them, you know, the worst thing you can do is kill their nest. Because then the Bible will turn right.
I wanted to relate to you a story from the middle length discourses of the Buddha. It's in Discourse 8. And I'll try to be brief about it. There is a monk goes to the Buddha and says something like this, that someone who is relatively new to their practice, who doesn't have very deep practice yet, could it be that they have in very shorthand, could it be that they've liberated themselves from wrong view? And the Buddha says, well, if... He doesn't say yes or no. He says, they could have if they have learned... if they can see with insight. If they see directly the empirical evidence upon which we build our worldviews from. If you look at that empirical evidence and really see it with insight, then that person would be free from all kinds of wrong views. And the idea behind the story is that this monk was concerned about new meditators who had a certain level of attainment, but hadn't really gone very deep in their practice. But because of a certain kind of initial kind of level of attainment, had gotten conceited and thought that they had really attained a lot. They were really hot stuff. So he goes to the Buddha and says, you know, are these guys really as hot as they're supposed to be? And the Buddha doesn't say yes or no. He says, if they have insight, then they're as hot as they say they are. If they have insight, then they've done what had to be done. And so the concern is that about, you know, people have overestimated their attainment. So that's just kind of an introduction to it. And then the Buddha seems to continue the discussion, taking it in a new direction. And he goes on and says, there are other people who overestimate the value of their attainment. And then he goes through and he lists all the 8 jhanas, all the 8 absorptions, and which are very important in the teachings of the Buddha, attaining these levels of deep concentration. So he's not poo-pooing their importance, but he's pointing that a person can easily get wrong conclusion based on these. They can overestimate their attainments, their value of these experiences. And he defines each of these 8 deep concentrations practices as providing a person with pleasant abiding here and now. And that's not to be knocked. So being at ease, being happy, being at peace in the here and now. But learning how to be deeply at peace here and now as a function of concentration does not involve a transformation of our inner core of who we are, the inner tendencies, inner workings of who we are. And there's no refinement or polishing of the character or changing us. And then, Buddha said, well, this itself does not provide with this transformation. And then he goes through and shows, this is how transformation occurs. And he goes through 44. I'm not going to read all of them. This is how transformation should be practiced by you. Others will be cruel. We shall not be cruel here. Thus, transformation should be practiced. And the word for cruel is ahimsa. And so maybe a better translation would be non-harming. Cruel being any kind of attempt to harm anybody else, any motivation. Then goes on to say, others will kill living beings. We shall abstain from killing living beings here. This is transformation. And then he goes through a whole bunch of things. And he thinks like, others will be envious. Others will be fraudulent. Others will be deceitful. Others will be resentful. Others will be difficult to admonish. Others will be negligent. Others will have... will be lazy. And we here don't do that. We train ourselves, we incline ourselves, we work on ourselves, we do the difficult practice of trying to change this aspect of who we are. And the first one that's listed is ahimsa. And the commentary says that's because everything else, all the other virtues follow on the foundations of being harmless. And so to tie these two together, that it's one thing to attain some level of calm or peace or ease or even insight in meditation practice itself. It's a whole other aspect of practice is to use that as a foundation to look at our lives and see where can we incline our lives to a transformation, to change our character, to refine ourselves. The word that I'm translating as transformation, in Thai it's translated as polish, to polish a person, to polish one's character or something. So to actually take something on and work on oneself and not just rely on meditation as this magic, you know, stone that's going to, you know, magically transform you into, you know, a more enlightened, a freer person. But you actually engage in certain virtues, certain principles, and you grapple with them, you work with them, you try, you incline your mind in that direction. And the last thing I'll say is that the state of mind that is inclined not to harm, the state of mind that is motivated by non-harming, is a very, very peaceful state of mind. And I would argue, or my experience is that not only is it peaceful, it's very, very deeply satisfying. It's a very closely related to the most deep satisfaction the person can have when they're centered at home, at peace with themselves. So one of the reasons for the practice of non-harming, for the virtue, the principle of non-harming, is to support and enhance the possibility of us individually discovering this very deep level of peace and satisfaction as we live our lives. So I hope that you have some sense of how the mindfulness practice can help in this regard, to use the meditation practice both for insight, but also as a foundation from which to then study more carefully some of these questions. And for example, the answer to your question, you know, when are you going to cross the line and, you know, get some kind of poison, for example? And I bet that you'd answer that question differently depending on whether you came out of meditation or whether you had spent this really frantic day, you know, at the DMV and nothing works and long lines and it's hot and you come home and, oh, my God. You know, the decisions we make, the moral decisions we make, is very much conditioned by the state of our mind to begin with. And so if you cultivate a really good state of mind, you probably find yourself making different decisions than if you make decisions, you know, when you're angry and things like that. So thank you all very much.